All right, good morning and welcome to this Court of Appeals Council. We are a little early this morning. It's 11:30. This case was scheduled for 11:40. We're prepared to proceed, but if you're waiting for someone to join that wanted to observe the argument virtually, you can tell us that and we'll wait till 11:40. Otherwise, we're ready to go.
I'm prepared to proceed, Your Honor.
I am as well, thank you.
All right. Very good. Well, our rules are the same here, even though we're appearing via Zoom, meaning each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal arguments and counsel for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. We are recording these proceedings and we'll make that recording publicly available in our normal course of business, but any additional recording is prohibited by our rules. And I would ask that you identify yourselves at the beginning of your argument for our record. So with that, we'll begin. And counsel for appellant, you may proceed when you're ready.
Good morning. My name is Zach Longsdorf. I represent appellant Marlo McDonald. Falsely impersonating another and aggravating forgery accounts in this case arose when Mr. McDonald gave a false name during booking, then used the same name on the same day in filling out a rights form or a public defender application in court while still in custody. The goal in first using a false name in booking was to avoid law enforcement knowing they had Marlo McDonald in custody. Then the use of the same name in court was to avoid detection and having used a false name to start with.
Mr. Longstar, on that issue, and I appreciate the arguments regarding to the same circumstances. Does the record indicate the time difference between the first act and the second act? I mean, I get it's the same day, but you know, if you look at our precedent and the Supreme Court's precedent, same day is better than not having the same day. But you know, you sort of. They're very focused on time. And I was wondering if there is if there's an indication, you know, was this an hour? Was this 12 hours? You know, blah, blah, blah.
The plea hearing transcript doesn't address that other than the fact that it says that it was the same day. And the tests for whether the crimes are part of the same behavioral incident are really stated in two different ways, sort of. One of them says the conduct to avoid apprehension for another crime is generally considered part of the same behavioral incident. And the courts are looking for some kind of temporal connection there. And then the other test is set out as sort of a three-part test that asks, one, whether they arose from a continuous and uninterrupted course of conduct, two, occurred at substantially the same time and place, and three, manifested an indivisible state of mind or were motivated by a single criminal objective. And I think under these circumstances that Mr. McDonald can satisfy both of those tests just through the transcript of the guilty pleas that he provided. And the first thing is this part about one offense is generally being considered part of the same behavioral incident if it's to avoid apprehension at an earlier offense. Crime one is falsely impersonating another at the jail by using the name Onassis Lloyd. Crime two is using that same name at court when he's taken there. The second use of the same fake name was criminal conduct to avoid apprehension on the first one. Once you use that fake name.
There's a difference. I appreciate the argument, but you know, one response to that could be, well, your position is he didn't want anybody to know about the warrant. My position is, well, maybe he didn't want to know anything about the warrant. That's the first crime. But the second crime was he wanted a public defender when he would otherwise be not eligible. Now, I know that's not in the record, just as the time is not in the record. But though, part of the analysis is there sort of like, could there be two different things? And I'm just saying, there could be two different things. So what do you think about that?
I suppose there could be two different things, and that sort of takes us to what was going to be the second part of my argument is the Williams case that puts the burden on the defendant petitioner after sentencing talks about, sort of analogizes a motion to correct a sentence in sort of the same terms of burdens as a petition for post-conviction relief. And it's our petition, our position, that if they're going to have the same sort of burdens, then it should be the same sort of pleading requirements, which is that in order for a defendant or a petitioner to be able to get a hearing, he needs to present evidence or allegations supported by more than mere argumentative assertions in order to have the opportunity to have a hearing to present that sort of evidence. Now, in this case, what Mr. McDonald has done is he provided his initial proof as part of his motion was that plea hearing transcript, and that does contain the sworn testimony taken by a district court judge from Mr. McDonald. And if there's an initial burden of showing that Mr. McDonald's claims are plausible and supported by more than mere argumentative assertions such that he should get a hearing, this should meet it. And it's troublesome, I think, that the district court treated Mr. McDonald as though he had, the complete burden of proof in his initial filing to satisfy every single aspect of it. When really, in our view, that's the sort of thing that you present these evidence with a sworn, or not the sworn, but the sworn testimony out of a transcript that was created as part of an official court hearing. And then you have an opportunity to present some evidence in it to satisfy all the elements. But we do believe that this can satisfy all elements of that. In a way, I would suggest to think about the timing of this would be the timing in places that Mr. McDonald was effectively in custody during all of this. Once he is under arrest and in the custody of the Blue Earth County Sheriff, he doesn't have any control over where he goes or when he goes somewhere. So really, when and where he is at all relevant times here is in custody. And that's where his acts took place. They were while he was in the custody of the Blue Earth County Sheriff on January 10th. And now, even if we sort of ignore the context of him being in custody and not having any ability to control when he goes somewhere or where he goes somewhere, I think that the Bookwalter and Langdon cases that were cited in Mr. McDonald's materials are helpful in understanding the distinction between sort of a change in location that's really directed by a defendant as part of the crime and just sort of an incidental change in location. Now, the Bookwalter case had a defendant who, after an assault, made an intentional decision to move the victim using her vehicle to a different location. And the court there gave quite a bit of significance to this change in location because the defendant intended it as part of the crime and allowed sentencing on two different things. The Langdon case involved robbing laundry rooms in several apartment buildings that were all part of the same complex. And I think from the facts, it looks like six or seven different laundry rooms in the same in buildings in the same complex. And what the court did there was they gave very little significance to the fact that there were different buildings in the same complex because of the singular criminal purpose of the defendant in that case. And I do think, I know here it could be that Mr. McDonald was trying to qualify for a public defender and not hide the first crime, but I think the testimony would come in if there was testimony that Mr. McDonald's purpose was in avoiding detection and having used a false name. And I don't think the record itself in that plea hearing transcript explicitly says that, but I know that if we sort of read through it, the district court judge is asking him, you know, your purpose is to avoid law enforcement, knowing, I think he called him Malcolm, but Malcolm McDonald, right? And Mr. McDonald says, yes, when he's talking about the booking. And then later when he's talking about the aggravated forgery from the courthouse, he asks sort of a similar question, but it's not exactly the same. But I think it's a pretty reasonable inference here, not having had the opportunity to present sort of maybe Mr. McDonald's testimony on that subject, that he was trying to avoid. He knew that he had done something wrong when he gave the first name, and he knows if he uses a different name after that he's going to be giving it up. So I do think there's a reasonable inference of that.
Mr. Longstorff, I'd like to go back to the burden of proof, because what you're arguing now
seems to be maybe not so much different, but it does not, I didn't see that anywhere in your briefing at all, in terms of there being an initial burden and then the burden switches back to the state. And you referenced the Williams case where the defendant, that states that the defendant clearly has a burden of proving that the sentence was based on incorrect criminal history score. Where can you point to anywhere within Williams that would support your position that there's only an initial burden of proof that the defendant has to meet and then the burden all of a sudden switches over to the other side? Because when I read Williams, that does not stand for that proposition at all. If anything, it makes it very, very clear that the defendant has a burden, and that seems consistent with the whole purpose of wanting to encourage defendants to challenge these early on so there's a clear record versus later on when it just doesn't, it seems like the record is lacking here.
I agree with your description of the Williams case. And if in my earlier explanation, it indicated I felt that a burden flipped back to the prosecution, that wasn't exactly what I was meaning. What I had meant was that essentially the district court, in its order, it kind of sums it up and says, he says, look, the defendant provided, not sure exactly where it is, but essentially the defendant provided this proof, but he hasn't satisfied every single element as part of his initial filing. And our position, and this is what we argued in our reply brief, is not that Mr. McDonald can flip the burden back to the prosecution, but that he should have an opportunity if he can sort of prove that his claims are plausible and if true would result in relief, have an opportunity to present some evidence or at least make an argument to the district court in support of that. And so our belief is that when
shouldn't he do that before the district post-conviction court, provide that evidence there? For example, I think as Judge Connolly rightly noted, I think the key issue is timing. Supreme Court seems to rely heavily to show that the timing has to be very, very close in time, but there's no evidence. I think that's what the post-conviction court said is, where's the evidence? And the defendant has the burden here, but the defendant hasn't come forward with evidence as to that time. We all know it's in the same day, but we don't know whether the time is actually how close in time it is. We also know that it's in two different locations, which is another factor that we look at. But why isn't the post-conviction court correct in saying there's no evidence of the timing here? It's nowhere to be found.
Well, I think that the district court is correct in concluding that there isn't anything more specific than it being the same day. But where we're going with this is that Mr. McDonald didn't get an opportunity himself to put that in the record. I suppose perhaps he could have made an affidavit and said, this is what I recall about the timing of it. But ultimately, to say Mr. McDonald's got the absolute and complete burden to prove every aspect of this and filing the motion doesn't really seem to me to fit within the context of the Williams case, which, I mean, this, all we're saying is that they analogize this motion to correct a sentence to a post-conviction. And in a post-conviction, a defendant doesn't have to have absolute proof of the claim to begin with. He needs to present, these allegations supported by more than mere argumentative assertions to get an opportunity to get in the court in front of the judge and present the evidence that would conclusively prove the claim. And so that's what Mr. McDonald will be asking for the opportunity to do here. But we do also believe that because he's in custody and because Mr. McDonald doesn't have any ability to say, where he's going, when he's doing something, or even why he's doing something, that there is sufficient proof in the transcript that this court can conclude that Mr. McDonald committed these acts essentially as part of one continuous activity, which is that when he's asked for a name at booking, he gives the fake name. The next time he's asked for a fake, or not for a fake name, when he's asked to give his name at court, this time when he's taken there, he gives the fake name. And the reason he does it is because if you stop using a fake name, then you've essentially admitted a crime. And so we do believe that this would fit squarely within those cases where a defendant committed the second crime in order to cover up the first one. And what I do think makes this case a little easier maybe than some of them that are in Mr. McDonald's brief is a lot of them, it's like the defendant has a DUI that he stopped for and gives a fake name, but then there's also a warrant in the fake name. And so if the defendant's purpose was avoiding the warrant, then he could be sentenced on both the DUI and on the fake name. So here, crime one, instead of being whatever Mr. McDonald was picked up for, crime one is the fake name at the jail. Crime two is the fake name at the courthouse. And so I don't think there's any other crime that could have been to cover up. So I think that helps tie those together in both sort of the continuity that is necessary for the to be a single behavioral incident. And absent any questions, I have nothing further.
Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Lonsdorf. Counsel for respondent, you may proceed.
Thank you. My name is Susan DeVos, and if it may please the court and counsel, I am here today representing the respondent, State of Minnesota. As the court correctly noted, although a defendant has the right at any time to challenge the legality of a sentence, when that happens at this juncture, post-appeal even, post-post-conviction even, we're at a point in which the burden has shifted to the defendant. In this case, the burden hasn't been met by Mr. Marlowe McDonald in either of his points, and I'd like to focus some on the out-of-state conviction argument that's made in his brief. That argument relies on the fact that Mr. Marlowe was given a point for his about an out-of-state or an Illinois conviction for burglary in support of his argument that should not have counted towards a point on his criminal history score. Mr. Marlowe McDonald has asserted that he's provided enough information to the court by simply providing a copy or describing the statute itself in Illinois and providing a copy of the certified conviction. There's no facts alleged to indicate what actually happened in that burglary in Illinois. Now, there's no dispute that he was convicted of burglary. There's no dispute that the burglary statute in Illinois is slightly broader than the burglary statute in Minnesota, but there needs to be something more than that. And the burden is not on the state to provide the underlying facts to what happened in that case. Certainly there are numerous ways in which a burglary conviction in the state of Illinois could be also meet the statute in Minnesota and would have therefore been equivalent to 1 point in Minnesota because it'd be equivalent to the Minnesota statute for burglary. There's just nothing in the record. And simply again, just citing to the statute and providing a copy of that conviction does nothing to provide us with information that would indicate that perhaps he burglarized a vehicle, which seems to be the assertion, but there's nothing there to provide the court or the state with any further information. If this was brought pre-sentencing, this would be a different story. It would have been on the state to provide that information, but we're not there anymore. And then looking to his alternative argument that perhaps it could be a theft, he again puts the burden on the state to determine how much the value of the item that he may have stolen during the burglary was. Again, there's two options under the theft statute that could something over 5,000 could have, if that were the equivalent, then it would have been 1 point. If it's under 5,000, it would have been a half a point. These are all speculative, Your Honors, but there's not even it's just a bare assertion, which is exactly what the court has said is not appropriate. So we are asking the court to determine that argument is just, it doesn't even meet the bare minimum threshold in this case, and that's why the district court didn't even grant a hearing. With regard to the second point on the continuing course of conduct, as the court correctly pointed out and Judge Connolly noted, there was no information with regard to time. That's correct. I don't see anything in the record either. But there is information that it is in a different location. Certainly there's a number of reasons why he could have decided he was going to continue with the false name assertion. But there has to be some relevance to the fact that it was a different time and a different place. Otherwise, this could carry on an infinite number of days in which he could have and continued to allege he had a different name. He went under the name of Mr. Lloyd. He signed the fingerprint card that way. He also once transported over to a different building to where the court hearing was held, signed his right sheet with a different name or with Mr. Lloyd's name. Where does it end? It could have happened the next day and the day after. And so it has to be relevant as to the time. It has to be relevant as to the day. And just has not met that burden that he needs to as to that this should have been a continuing course of conduct. And then finally, even if everything that Mr. McDonald has argued here is correct, his math is wrong at a bare minimum. And even under his argument that the burglary conviction from out of state should really have been determined to be akin to a theft for an item under $5,000, it leaves him with a half a point rather than a full point. And then even if the court drops off the one of the two for the two different incidents in January of 2003, one equated to a 1 point and the other to a half a point, you drop the lower. So the half a point would drop off as well. Totaling those up at most, it is a 1 point deduction total between the two, leaving us with 5 criminal history points. But again, the state does not concede in any way that any of the points should drop off. And at this point, we are requesting that this court uphold the district court's decision denying his motion to correct his sentence and affirm. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. DeVos. Mr. Longsdorf, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you wish, sir. You're muted, sir.
Thank you. I just want to briefly kind of address the argument that this would, there's no ending point to Mr. McDonald's argument that this, you know, as long as he's using the same name, it could be forever. That's just not the facts that we have to deal with here. We know it was the same day. We know we booked him. We know how the court process works, that they bring him before a judge. He has his initial appearance. And so it's the same day. And we're not making an argument that it was a week later and a different name or anything like that. Just to sum it up, Mr. McDonald is in custody. He's presented for booking. He uses the fake name. He's taken to the courthouse. It's not like he goes there on his own, but he goes to the courthouse. He's presented there with some paperwork. He signs it with the same name. The very reasonable inference is that he's using that same name to avoid giving up the fact that he had used that in the first place and it's not his name. And I think under the circumstances that there is a connectedness in both time and place, particularly in that these are both government buildings and Mr. McDonald wasn't sort of the instigator of the movement to conclude that they're part of the same behavioral incident and therefore it was inappropriate to grant or to use points for both of them. And if that is the case, it does take him down just on that one to 5.5 points, which would reduce his criminal history score. And if he were sentenced to the guideline sentence again, that would result in a deduction of about a year. And it, since the sentence was doubled, perhaps 2 years. So there would be a change there. Regarding the Chicago conviction, it's Mr. McDonald presented the certified disposition. Again, if we treat this similar to a post-conviction in terms of initial burdens in pleadings, that's Mr. McDonald's petition position that that is sufficient, that he should have been then given a hearing or an opportunity to present the final evidence to support that claim. Absent any further questions, I do not have any further argument.
Seeing none from the panel, thank you, counsel, for your arguments in the matter and your briefing on the issues. We will take the matter under advisement at this time, and we will issue our decision within the statutory timeframe. We stand adjourned on this matter.